In the future, human beings will subsist on little more than tuna fish sandwiches and cheese aerosol spray. Ravaged by the foolish overextension of credit, human entertainment will be limited to half-hearted games of tiddlywinks and bad banjo players forming sad skiffle bands. Houses will be transformed into tents made of bearskin rugs and IKEA bed frames. Violent wars will be fought by gangs over the illicit drug of caffeine. When there's skim milk all the way. But that's actually the rosy, optimistic view when compared to the bleak, dystopian speculation offered by writer Paolo Bacigalupi. Bacigalupi sees a future far worse. So grab the popcorn and enjoy the show! Okay, so I am here with Paolo Bacigalupi, who is most recently the author of Shipbreaker. Paolo, how are you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
I wanted to go ahead and drift away from the obvious questions and start to a somewhat obvious but less obvious questions. I know that you wrote four novels before The Wind-Up Girl, and all four of these were rejected. I think it's also safe to say that your fiction does, in fact, border on the bleak and pessimistic. It's not always a party hour in the Apollo universe.
Right.
At the risk of possibly invoking Schopenhauer, I actually wanted to ask about how this will to continue to write, this determination, relates in some sense to this kind of bleak temperament within your fiction, or was it there all along, even before you you started the great wheel, so to speak?
I think that the bleakness was always sort of there. The first novel that I wrote was rejected specifically because it was so bleak. The editors said things like, you know, as a mother, this disturbs me. This is all downer.
As a mother.
Yeah. I was particularly proud of that one. So it's always been pretty dark stuff that I've written. But I think also partly I was just, fumbling around, still trying to figure out what I was trying to do with my fiction and trying to have a little bit more purpose. I'm such a pessimist about the way the world works and the way even my own sense of my life. I'm not sure why I was so optimistic enough to keep writing.
Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if this early apprentice period was almost a way to get yourself to trust this temperament, to see how, I suppose, this bleakness that was there all along could work its way into fiction, or was it simply a matter of you're operating in a genre market which is even more limited than even a general fiction market? I mean, what of this this relationship between temperament to fiction?
You know, I think that a lot of what I would there's a bunch of different layers to this about. And one of them was, I think that the thing that really I was learning the entire time was that I actually like to write specifically. I like the act of writing. And that wasn't actually always clear to me. I wanted to write because I had a goal. I wanted to be published. I wanted to be famous. I wanted to be whatever, you know, all the ego reasons for writing. And after I'd written all those books and had completely failed, that was really the key takeaway for me. It wasn't so much what I would write about or the direction I wanted to take my art or anything like that. It was simply that I enjoyed the act of writing and that I feel better when I write than when I don't write, and that's a meditative space for me, and that's a very comforting space for me to be creating. And so I think that was the biggest lesson learned. And then the shift, really, I think, that happened was that when I switched to the short fiction markets, are far more open to a dark vision or two inside of their, you know, the book. You know, if you're looking at FNSF, they can follow with something that's fun and light after me. And so it's not all Paolo Bacigalupi grimness all the time. And so they can take a risk on a story and make that part of the mix of experiences that their readers are going to get. And that was, like, I think that was the other thing, was sort of shifting back to short fiction, was that realization that maybe novels were never going to be my thing, and that might be okay, because at least I got to write, and people would get to see my stories, and there was a place for them, so.
I wanted to talk specifically about specifics. By this I mean...
By all means, yeah. Let's get specific.
Yes. Your early stories, you have The Fluted Girl, The Calorie Man, and Yellow Card Man.
Right.
These are loaded with imaginative detail. But
It's a very particular type of imaginative detail. I want to offer an example for people who aren't familiar with your work. One sentence from Yellow Card Man. There was a time when he sent clipper fleets across the ocean to Chennai with great stinking loads of durians because he guessed that the Indians had not had time to plant resistant crop stains before the new blister rust mutation swept over them. Now, that's very reminiscent of William Gibson's hyperspecificity, but you are also allowing the reader to fill in the gaps. You know, what is Chennai? What is durians? I'm curious, at what point did you figure out how to, because I know Gibson is an influence for you, how you went from that hyper-specific nature of prose to really being aware of the reader and giving the reader enough details with which to, you know, oh, I want to look this stuff up. I want to kind of use my imagination to fill in the gaps, because you don't always explain, particularly in
the wind-up universe,
how the world has gone to hell.
There's an interesting sort of combination of enough specificity to hint it at the larger world without actually having to go into every single freaking detail.
Yeah.
And I've definitely read writers who do spend a lot of time on every freaking detail. At some point, it bogs down the story. I think you're trying to find a balance between sort of efficiency, speed, a little bit of art. I really trust, though, that there's, for a reader, that actually the most spectacular things for the reader's mind are all the things that you don't describe. It's the whiff of the idea that's more fascinating. And that's always been the way for me when I'm reading other people's stuff, is that moment when they've illustrated just enough for me to understand a part of the world that I can go off and illustrate myself, and I'm going to do it much better in my own head than the writer would ever do if they laid it all out. And I don't know exactly where you find that. I mean, some of those things, in some ways, they're, you know, when we talk about that specific example, Chennai, for me, is a place that I think of as one of the spots where my in-laws live. And so it's a place that has its own specificity for me, whether or not it has a specificity for the reader, whether that's an imaginative place or whether that's a specific place with a specific history, all those kinds of things. It doesn't matter to me in some ways. I'm just interested in sort of laying out the landscape that the details of that landscape that are interesting to me, and then hopefully there's enough there for people to grab onto. And sometimes, I mean, you read it in reviews of The Wind-Up Girl or whatever, that sometimes people feel like there really aren't enough, and they feel like they're sort of like fingernails scrabbling across glass or something, that they just can't get enough to hang on to. And other people, it seems to calibrate just about right.
Yeah. Well, this makes me also wonder how much of this has worked in advance, or are you essentially, like, for example, with Chennai, you're drawing from your in-laws' experience. You have these almost repositories of data that you're just swimming in,
right,
and that you're so steeped in that it really doesn't matter if you know every nook and cranny of the universe. I'm curious, you know, to what degree do you plan versus improvise through a sentence such as this?
It's almost all improvisation, actually. Yeah. Very little is planned out. There's a detail that I have in my bank, and I use it. And, you know, you're always acquiring material, whether that's, you know, from visiting your in-laws, or whether that's from, you know, reading a novel, somebody else's novels, or reading some, you know, natural history of the world, whatever it is. You're always gathering material. And so then it's just there, and I don't even know why, you know, oh, at this moment, I'm looking for a detail that does this kind of a thing. I want to indicate the scope of the world, or I want, in this particular case, I want to indicate a little bit of the scope of the calorie companies, you know, things like that. And, okay, where can I go to do that? What do I have in my repository that seems like a useful tool for that? And then I'll start pulling things down. But so there's an intention that I have. There's something I want to illustrate. There's an experience I want to sort of get deeper into. But then which pieces are going to go into it, that's very much on the fly.
How, in terms of this being on the fly, how does it work in relation to devising an imaginative concept versus language? Does phrasing sometimes kickstart a concept more than, say, just what you have in the bank, so to speak? I mean, you know, I know, for example, psyllid instead of penicillin.
Right.
And little things like that we often find in your universes.
Right.
So the question, I suppose, is how much language motivates the spontaneity versus how much some leg that you have motivates that particular spontaneity.
I don't know. It's sort of a combination. The spot actually where I remember actually a piece of language inspiring me to write a story actually was connected more to the people of Sand and Slag. When I wrote that short story, there had been a little piece of sort of microfiction that I'd written. I'd written a paragraph, and And it was all about these people sort of lying out on the beach and chopping each other up. And it was sort of compelling, but I didn't have any idea what to do with it. But I liked the prose. I liked the rhythms of it. And that there was something so bizarre about it that I knew that I liked it. That became a part of the bank. You know, that went in and just sort of sat there for a very, very long time until much later I was starting to play around with some other concepts from People of Sand and Slag. And then it was suddenly that thing was there. And, I get it. These people are immortal. These people are regenerative. They can do all of these things. And this is the perfect illustration for this cascade. And so this piece of very sort of, you know, we'll call it quote-unquote poetic prose, then almost none of it survived to enter into the story, but the prose of that, the experience of it for me, resonated strongly enough that it could then inform an entire piece.
Yeah. And, well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I actually do want to ask about a recurrent theme. It's here in Shipbreaker as well, and that is, you know, in Sand and Slag, we have violence directed towards girls or women. The wind-up girl has that with Aniko. The fluted girl, of course, has that. It concludes on an act of revenge. I'm curious as to why you were really drawn to the kind of the violent, real degrading violence towards girls and women like that. Whether it's just part of the bleak temperament, or you feel that that's really a good way to get the audience to feel sympathy towards that, these particular characters, or whether it's just an environmental reality that you want to convey.
I think that honestly, this actually comes in at different moments for different stories, and you're really illustrating very specific things. I don't think that the violence that you see for Emiko is pretty manipulative violence, because you're really trying to get to a point where you generate enough empathy for her that later on she can go on a slaughter fest, and that you feel that that's entirely reasonable. One of the things that's sort of interesting to me is, like, I felt very comfortable depicting her being degraded at one early point in the story, and yet I didn't depict her doing the slaughter later on. And the reason is I want to maintain character empathy there. And if you see more than just the blood on the walls, if you see her tearing every single piece of meat and bone out of every one of her enemies, then you might not have that later empathy for her at the very end of the story. And so a lot of this is just manipulations, honestly. It's just flat out manipulation. And it's interesting. I mean, so in the People of Sand and Slag, the guy is the one who's being dismembered as an experiment and sort of sex fun. And so I'm not sure. I mean, it definitely shows up every once in a while. Softer, definitely. The woman is killed by her husband, and that one too has some disturbing aspects. Who knows? You know, maybe I'm a misogynist.
I'm not gonna go ahead and put that label down, but I am curious about this. I mean, we're talking about manipulation versus empathy, and this also leads me to ask you about Lopez in Shipbreaker, the father.
Right.
He's a very brutal character. I'm wondering if there were efforts on your part to try to make him more sympathetic, or when does a character, I suppose, become violent and almost serves as a manipulative way to get the audience to sympathize with the hero?
Right. With Lopez, Richard Lopez, he's sort of based on my own. I had a next door neighbor who was sort of a crystal meth addict, and so I've never really had much sympathy for addicts anyway. And so I was perfectly happy to have that villain role fulfilled by him. And honestly, I wanted to illustrate a certain, in a lot of ways, over the top idea of what point you sort of look around at family and say that family is no longer family, that they aren't really valuable anymore, and that they need to be done away with. And I tend to think of almost all human relations as contingent relations. Everything is dependent on good behavior. I don't really believe in the idea that family is family or that friends are friends. It's whether or not every day you're sort of earning your friendship or earning the connections and support of your family, and vice versa. And so for me, I just really wanted to illustrate Richard Lopez's sort of break, you know, with those, with any sense of, like, his obligations, the mutual obligations of family.
Yes.
So,
to go under the hood a little bit further, I actually wanted to ask you about a specific a stylistic momentum you do in your sentences, just to give you some examples. It's where you go from essentially simple past tense verb to present participle in your sentences, and you often have the commas there. For example, he squatted, panting on the deck.
Right.
Or Naylor curled on the ground, panting and dizzy.
Right.
The ship's deck was tilted, showing a buckle cannon.
Right.
I'm curious how this way of shifting the tense just so slightly developed and how this works in relation to just keeping the gas on the pedal here. Just lots of pulp reading, or
there's something habitual about some of the phrases that I use. I noticed it most recently. I actually noticed that I was reading from an early section of The Wind Up Girl, and I suddenly noticed this relentless pattern almost to the sentence structure, and God, I hated it. So I don't know. I'm probably going to shift it around now.
I mean, on some level, though, you have to be true to your innate sentence pattern. So aren't you being a little hard there?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, at one point, I felt like it was the perfect vehicle. You know, obviously, when I wrote it, I felt very good about it. And then there was some point later on where I was reading it, I thought, I don't like... I'm really aware of the rhythmic connections between the different sentences and you know, that varying rhythm and pulse of sentence, from sentence to sentence, from paragraph to paragraph, really interests me, and I get really tied into that, what feels right. And there is something there that that I think of as my natural pacing. But that said, there's also some point where you think, wow, I am repetitive, or I'm not actually, I'm only using one tool.
Yeah.
And, you know, where is the point where this tool actually is overused and broken? I think in some ways, you know, that might be why some people bogged down in an early part of The Wind Up Girl, is that it's possible that rhythmic tool is being overused and sort of slows them enough that they suddenly are like, oh, I'm bored, as opposed to, you know, that if there was a slight variation in the way that they were experiencing those sentence patterns, that would actually keep them moving through the text in a way that they otherwise bogged down. I don't know. I've always interested by the people who find the text entirely enticing versus those people who find it almost so opaque that they just won't bother.
I noticed that on the Ology site that there is a rather obsessive lists of, you know, frequency of words,
right,
that has been generated, presumably by you.
I haven't looked at that site, so
okay.
I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, someone has done that. I'm wondering if John Banville has this situation where he will only use like one of his favorite words or a crutch word like once within a book. I'm wondering if you have anything similar like this, like for example, spray, where there's a spray moment, for example, in Shipbreaker, and there's a spray moment in The Wind-Up Girl, but you're also, you. I noticed that you're like, oh, I can only use spray a couple of times.
Right.
If I use it anymore, I'm going to get annoyed or something like that.
You're always trying to be aware of when you're overusing a word that you really love or a phrase that you really love. There's two spots in Shipbreaker. I won't even say where they are, but I literally end a chapter almost exactly the same way twice in Shipbreaker. And you can go dig around and see if you can find it, But I only noticed it, you know, after the book had come out. And I'm like sitting there looking at it going, my God, yes, that gives me a wonderful emotional feeling in these two spots. And clearly I couldn't resist it. It felt so natural to move right into this certain phrasing and this certain descriptive space, and that I did it twice. And later on, you can only look back and say, whoa, what a fuck up. You know, I should have done that once. I should have only given myself one of those, and the other one needed to have some variation there. But you know, I don't know. A lot of times when you're writing, it sort of feels like you're so deep inside of an unconscious space or a dreaming space that, you know, the fetishistic use of everything from spray to blood to horizon to, you know, whatever the word is, you can't necessarily even control that. I mean, that might be your voice in essence, you know, is that compulsion to continually return to certain experiences or feelings. So
going back to these four unpublished novels, I'm wondering, you do have this dilemma that you're talking about, like, oh, I can't use this language, or I can't end it the specific way. I'm wondering if you have made efforts to cannibalize from these four novels, or have you made second attempts?
I've gutted them. I've pulled pieces out. I've used, you know, scenes and feeling, you know, moments that like I explored and felt, you know, oh, this was a great moment, you know, I'll never use that in any other space. I actually feel like I did that a little bit when I was writing Wind Up Girl and felt like I was going back into my short stories in some ways and mining from short stories, because one of the things I felt like was that almost nobody has read my short stories. And when you know, this is something that the people who've really read all of the stuff that I've written will notice, is that, oh, gee, the Wind Up Girl really feels like, you know, these short stories. I was kind of looking for more. I was looking for more of a new experience. And I understand that. But one of the things I was thinking about when I wrote the Wind Up Girl was that the novel was going to be reaching an audience that had never experienced me before and that had never known about me as a short story writer. And so you're wanting to, you need to bring them in to certain things. And so there was absolutely a moment where I'm going back and mining certain components or certain feelings from my short stories and importing those into the novel space so that I could give people sort of that first introduction to what I'm up to. And so that would be an easier entry as well. You know, if you're expecting that everybody's read, you know, The Calorie Man and Yellow Card Man in order to move forward, like, you know, it's sort of an unreasonable expectation. Do your homework and then read the novel.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's also, I mean, I read it in reverse, where I read Wind Up Girl, then I went back to Calorie and Yellow Card.
Right, right.
It's like, oh, well, there, here's the template, but here's the explanation. So
right.
it actually allows the reader working in reverse to essentially confirm or even have his own expectations completely uprooted.
Right, yeah, that actually, I'm sort of interested in that dynamic now, because Pump 6 and Other Stories is now out in trade paperback, and so in some, most people actually will be experiencing it in reverse order.
Yeah.
And that was actually something that was quite a puzzle for me when I was writing Wind Up Girl, was how much of the world did I want to go into again, and how much, you know, what's the focus of this particular novel in terms of explaining world when I have explained world in the previous, you know, short stories, when I have explained certain aspects of the world. And it's you know, it's a very muddy sort of analysis about how you're going to do that and what you're really going to how well it succeeds. I mean, it apparently succeeded well enough, at least.
But isn't there a certain liberation in riffing on a theme that you've already set up? Suddenly, you don't have to establish, you know, you don't have to have the origin story. It's already been done. So therefore, you can kind of figure out, okay, why.
No, it only works, though, if you're assuming that your reader is a reader who's familiar with the origin story. I mean, and that's the problem, is your audiences are bouncing around. I mean, this is something that's interesting to me, too, about something like Shipbreaker, which is thematically similar to some things in Wind Up Girl. There's global warming, there's peak oil, certain things are givens within the world. Now, people who are transferring from the Wind Up Girl over to Shipbreaker are in some ways already booted up to experience a world like that.
Yeah.
But the reality is that there's actually very few people who are crossing over, either from Shipbreaker into Wind Up Girl or from Wind Up Girl into Shipbreaker. They function almost entirely, they're genre separate. And even though I think of them all as science fiction, they actually are functioning genre separate, Shipbreaker being young adult and Wind Up Girl being science fiction. And so it sort of feels like even if you've done the origin stories over here, all of the tools for unpacking a successful story have to be inside of that story specifically. And so honestly, I actually find it a little bit constricting to still be working in the same world, because you still feel like I need this story to unpack itself successfully, not for me to be referring back to earlier stuff and have that unpack it, you know, do the work, you know, short of being an explicit series, I suppose. You know, that. Yeah, you know, so I don't know. I mean, I'm still figuring out how to write a series. I actually was expecting Shipbreaker to be a direct series, and I totally screwed it up. And now I'm writing a companion novel because I can't quite figure that out. How much do I need to? How much can I count on the readers already being familiar with versus how much do I need to unpack within the sequel? And so in the end, I just threw that idea away and ended up writing a companion novel instead. So that's what I'm working on now. So
what I'm wondering, though, is why you didn't just try to have Shipbreaker be loosely related to the Wind Up Girl universe. I mean, did you make an early effort to make it cohesive? Like,
No. I didn't want to. There are certain ideas that I was really with the Wind Up Girl. I was interested in peak oil. I was interested in energy, and I was interested in GM food. And GM food was really, really huge for me. And that was, you know, that's the origin story in Calorie Man, is that it's genetically modified foods, the power of the agricultural corporation, and I can bring in peak oil and a loss of energy as this sort of illustrative cascade of energy, food being energy, being power, being control, you know, this whole cascade. And it's an interesting metaphor, but it doesn't... structurally sort of hold up in a lot of ways. There's, you know, lots of people say, well, where's the solar? Where's the wind? Where's the, you know, where's the hydro? Whatever they're, you know, where's the coal diesel? Where's the whatever the
where's
thing
the
is?
Where's the Cheshires that, like, and where are the Megadonts?
Right, yeah. Right. Why do these, well, I mean, but, you know, all those things inside of The Wind-Up Girl, I actually was really concerned about writing that story out at novel length because there are certain fallacies about in a predict as a, it's not a predictive future. It's a metaphorical future. And so when you're talking about if you're going to have a story that focuses directly on the ideas of peak oil and taking that really seriously as opposed to ideas of GM foods, which is what I was actually interested in when I started writing in the Wind-Up Girl universe.
Yeah.
You all of that, all of the calories, all of the kink springs, all of the megadons, all that stuff doesn't function well inside the story. If your actual emphasis is peak oil, and so I felt like I wanted to reboot and look specifically at, you know, global warming and peak oil, and then start thinking about some other kinds of technologies, things like the clipper ships and stuff. And
yeah.
And so it was baggage that I didn't want to have inside of this other universe.
Yeah.
And so no, I was perfectly relieved actually to sort of say, this is Wind-Up Girl land over here, you know, and this is Shipbreaker land. And while there are some thematic similarities, these are not, you know, they are not about the same thing, and they're focused.
I have to ask.
I'm aiming for different outcomes.
Sure, sure. But I also have to point out that both universes begin, or at least have New Orleans as a very big part of them, and I'm curious about that. I mean, I don't think it's entirely a response to Katrina, but it is interesting that the first wind-up story and this one both involves iterations of Orleans too.
Right. Yeah, I can't remember exactly when Katrina happened in relation to when I was writing Calorie Man.
Yeah.
I see. It's interesting, actually. New Orleans, I think, in the Calorie Man specifically, actually was, I had originally, okay, so long and
no worries,
boring backstory here, maybe for people, but I had originally written the nub of a story, which was set in Bangkok and would eventually become The Wind-Up Girl. That was so packed as a story that I didn't feel like I could write it, and I didn't want to write it as a novel, and so I started spinning short stories out of it. One of the ideas that was the most interesting was the idea of calories as currency, calories as energy, calories as the solution to the peak oil question, and then agribusiness. And I originally actually wanted to set this story on the Mekong River. I wanted a very much a Hearts of Darkness sort of story. But I realized that was a stupid place to put it, because if you're going to have the Hearts of Darkness story, the place needs to be the calorie companies. It needs to be in the heartland. It's going into the heartland of the calorie companies. So I moved to the Mississippi. Moving it to the Mississippi then created this whole cascade of other decisions about who the calorie smuggler was going to be, what he was like, what his values were. And New Orleans just sort of ended up, it's lying at the mouth of the Mississippi was sort of an accidental object. I don't think it actually meant much more than that. It was the Mississippi that was important to me, and Iowa. Those were the important things. It's just that downriver needed to exist as the launching point for all of the grains as they go out by boat to the rest of the world. But, you know, it wasn't actually a fetish object for me. I think by the time Katrina happened, that, you know, it sort of snapped into your view, and you were really paying attention then to what does this city look like, how is it designed, and really, let's be honest, what is its future? And so by the time I was writing Shipbreaker, you know, you definitely have this sort of sense of futility looking at this, is how high are we planning on building those levees? And, I mean, you know, what we call a 100-year flood isn't going to always be a 100-year flood. That's going to be a moving baseline. And so as global warming has more and more impact, you know that there, you know, New Orleans is in for a tough haul, and
yeah.
Bangladesh is in for a tough haul, and, you know, these low-lying areas, they aren't best situated. And so this was an opportunity to sort of take that one step out. It's like, it's nice that they're repairing the levees or whatever, but let's be honest, like,
yeah.
what's the end game here?
And, a very simple line, like a world of Category 6 hurricanes.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wanted to also, speaking of that, the teeth, the tops of buildings that are encountered in Shipbreaker.
Right.
You know, you have the sentence, the people who had built the teeth had misjudged the sea rise
quite a lot,
which
right.
is a bit of an
yeah.
understatement. But before that proper collective noun shows up, I should point out that you do have a lot of descriptive teeth in this. You have Lopez smiling, showing teeth all splayed out like a hand. Tool's big damn teeth, cited by TikTok.
Right, right.
I'm wondering if these descriptive teeth came in revision, or if there was a coordination attempt between the capitalized teeth and these very real teeth. Yeah,
I'm always interested in biting and tearing. Yeah, honestly, yeah. I think that's really what it is. I think it's just a fetish for me. It's just biting and tearing and bones and, you know, the physical manifestations of bodies. And then I was interested, actually, I think the closer connection between the city drowned with the teeth that poke up is actually the bones of the oil tankers being flayed and stripped and torn apart as they work down the flesh, as all these shipbreakers are tearing the flesh of the accelerated age away. And I don't know, for some reason I return again and again to body metaphors. And that might actually be becoming also a shtick that needs to be changed. But those body metaphors, I see them showing up a lot in my stuff. And it's interesting because I finally actually have enough writing to look at it and start seeing my own patterns. I didn't used to have that. And so, you know, you're trying to think, is this a deliberate thing that I love, or is this a nervous tick, or is this lazy writing, or is this, you know, trying to make those decisions. But yeah, body metaphors, like there's something about the physical structure of bodies, the bones, the viscera, everything that always have fascinated me. And I sort of like returning to those metaphorical chunks when I'm trying to describe other things. So
nobody has asked you, at least I checked for interviews, but nobody had asked you, speaking of the body, whether J.G. Ballard was an influence. And I always was curious if you had boned up on that at all.
The only thing by J.G. Ballard that I've read is Empire of the Sun.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The least body-like of the, you know,
right,
the bunch.
Yeah. I've never read, like, Crash or any of those.
Yeah.
I'm curious about them, and, you know, maybe I'll get around to it sometime. But the only one I've read is Empire of the Sun. And actually, that was fascinating more for me as the thing that did inform me there was the perspective of a boy watching, you know, the conquering Japanese come into Shanghai and the profound respect that he has for this people who are dominating his own people. And that's the imperial experience. It's like, oh my God, who are these outsiders coming in who've torn apart my own people, and who am I going to respect? I'm going to respect my oppressor. And that perspective is so interesting and so convoluted, and there's so many layers to that experience that it was a great illustration of how much we depend on the events around us to sort of define ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's something that actually I feel like has ended up in a lot of my fiction down through the line, is that, you know, as the world, my characters live inside of these broken worlds, and how they look out at the world, and then how they form their identity and their sense of self based on the facts on the ground around them. And that, I think that's something actually that I got specifically from J.G. Ballard.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we're on this topic, because I also wanted to ask about the question of how some of these outlandish and phantasmagorical elements, you know, some writers will say, well, this is really a consequential output of, you know, of what's going on right now, of what I'm extrapolating at the present moment. It may seem crazy to you, but it is absolutely rooted in what I'm soaking in, the bank metaphor we were using in the very beginning of this conversation. I'm curious, at what point, if you do this, do you stray away from reality and just make shit up, versus the consequential concern, which I think, based off of what we've been talking about, seems to be more your mode.
I you know, in science fiction, you're always making everything up anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's sort of and then you get into these sort of dickering matches over, like, well, this isn't really real because we know that, you know, hydrogen is going to be the next fuel source. So we know that this isn't real because, you know, solar this. Or we know that, you know, and there's, you know, you look at data points and you start to say, well, does this data point seem like the ascendant data point? And you know, who the hell knows? I mean, you know, it's like we've got coal resources in Montana that are vast.
Yeah.
And so assuming that we really don't give a damn about global warming at all, and that we can sort of mitigate against, you know, sort of our ecosystems unraveling at the same time as global, because of global warming, then maybe, you know, coal is really our next fuel source, and we're actually going to be quite powerful and rich for a long time in the energy sense, because we're willing to liquefy a lot of coal. You know, that's an extrapolation that you can go out and say is perfectly reasonable. So taking these specific data points, at some point you're applying an aesthetic to the data, and that's going to be pretty arbitrary. And I think every science fiction writer's arbitrary sense of aesthetic is both the interesting thing about what a science fiction writer does, but it's also, you know, it is arbitrary.
Yeah.
And there's another layer, at least for me, which is, well, do I just think this thing is fucking cool? And, you know, Cheshire's make no sense, but I fucking love having a Cheshire. I love the metaphor back to Lewis Carroll. I love that they function well as a disruptive species.
Yeah.
And so I want them there in the story because they're cool. I don't care if it doesn't make sense because it makes sense within the scope of the made-up universe. And that's enough for me. So your mileage may vary.
You know,
that's, and certainly it does. It certainly varies quite a lot for some people. So,
yeah. Well, it's that's interesting. But also the Cheshires, I mean, you have the characters in some of these stories, like, you know, hunting them down and using them for meat.
Sure.
But they don't actually bear any... There's no character definition, really, to the Cheshires. So therefore, they can perhaps be a sort of inexplicably surrealistic but cool element that crops up in the story. This leads me to also ask one thing. We were talking a little bit about, you know, the fluted girl, the wind-up girl, characters who tend to have some artificial element. And I'm wondering, you know, when you're thinking about character description, how does an artificial element serve in a manner that is either different or stronger or weaker than, say, like someone who has a more tangible character description, like, you know, someone with a bum leg or someone with
missing a hand,
yeah, exactly,
or whatever, the scar across their face. Honestly, the difference is that they're inherent to the story. You know, the person with a scar across their face, the person with the bum leg, short of you actually deciding to write a story that's specifically about somebody who is differently abled, in which case the idea of the story and the description of the character are intermeshed.
Yes.
You know, that's the key there. All of the characters, you know, or many of my characters are altered. You know, whether it's somebody in People of Sand and Slag, they're immortal.
Yeah.
There's a reason that integrates completely with the story about how they regenerate, why you chop off a limb, and why that's both aesthetically interesting, but also specific to the larger theme of the story. The Fluted Girl... Everything. The reason why she's altered is because she is a piece of performance art.
Yeah.
And this is a demonstration not just of her existing as a piece of performance art, but also the capacity of somebody else to alter her life and control her life. And so all of those things are packed together. And so, you know, there's consequences to that, you know, that she's very fragile, all those other aspects about her. But The alterations to the character should, in my mind at least, be specific to the larger metaphor that you're working with, I guess. And, you know, similarly, it's the wind-up girl, the alterations, she's supposed to be an outsider. She's supposed to, you know, like having a bum leg doesn't quite get you there.
Yeah.
And having a scar, being ugly doesn't get you there. She has to be fundamentally different. She has to be fundamentally different in a way that other people can see in a moment that she's fundamentally different. She ain't human, you know. She has to move in a way that looks fundamentally unnatural, so that she can be the other.
Yeah.
And be defined that way, as opposed to something like, I don't know, Friday, you know, Heinlein's,
yeah,
you know, super bot, if you will, where, you know, well, gee, there's nothing different about her except for that she's super.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, that's kind of fun too, but that's not really, it doesn't make sense when you're actually talking about the other being, you know, this despised cast or class.
And they often are, so, for a rather ridiculously, for almost very little, you are declared the other, I suppose.
Right.
You mentioned Lewis Carroll, and actually this made me want to ask you about another potential influence. In Shipbreaker, you have a ship called the Dauntless. You also have a line early on where Pima says, "There's crabs out that way." Made me ask if this was like James Lennox Kerr, possibly, in his Dauntless books.
No. Okay. I don't even know them. No. I actually was thinking of things like Patrick O'Brien and Horatio Hornblower.
Yeah, I got that vibe, definitely.
That was there in my head. I liked the Hornblower novels quite a lot.
And, yeah.
and later on got into some of the Patrick O'Brien stuff. But really, the heart of that story was all Heinlein.
Yeah.
The heart of that was Citizen of the Galaxy, like, rebooted. You know, the kid in poverty who sort of claws out. And, you know, it's a combination probably of Citizen of the Galaxy and maybe Starman Jones or something, if you, you know. In the very general sense, it's that boy who learns better story, and that's the heart of it. And anything else connected to it is sort of the window dressings on the way to that destination of telling that story of the boy who learns better, an adventure story. You know, the thrill of a young person succeeding.
Yeah. Extrapolating from books, extrapolating from facts. I'm wondering if, as the more books get published and more technologies get introduced, whether it is becoming harder for you to, I suppose, prognosticate or imagine or extrapolate.
No.
No?
No, not at all. Actually, it's interesting. A lot of people have said that it's very difficult to write. I'm so focused on different kinds of ideas than, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit around trying to figure out what's happening next with data networks. That's not, it neither interests me particularly, nor does it, I'm not sure that it actually gets to the underlying question marks that I'm really interested in, like, yeah. I feel like are really relevant. You know, it's whether or not those networks are going to be burning coal or hydro, or whether they're going to be using hydro, or what they're going to be doing. Are they going to be solar? You know, that's the question. Where does our root source of power come from? That's an interesting question to me. I'm interested in the question of, if we keep knocking off species, you know, at what point does our ecosystem actually unravel? That's not actually, like, we actually know really clearly, there's no question in our future that we're going to knock off more species. So that actually is a pretty easy thing to run out. And I feel pretty confident saying, yeah, we're going to keep killing more species. There are more species that are going to go extinct, and it's going to be our fault, and we probably won't give a damn. But at some point, you really do irreversible damage to an ecosystem, and then, gee, it turns out we depend on ecosystems for our survival, and so what does that look like?
Yeah.
So no, the all the technologies, all that stuff, it's all window dressing based on what our underlying support structures are, and I'm much more interested in the underlying support structures. It's the energy sources, it's the food sources, it's the ecosystem services that provide our prosperity. Those are the things that are really interesting for me. And that, you know, all of this stuff on the top that depends on that, that's all very fascinating, but it doesn't ask, you know, well, gee, where did our stuff come from? Where does it go to die? And does that matter? You know, is there a question mark that we haven't explored there?
And yet what's interesting with your work is that no matter how dystopian the results, there is still, to offer an Aristotelian idea, there is still a class system in place, even in Shipbreaker, the swanks, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, is it your contention or possibly your exploration point for fiction that class systems will exist irrespective of the...
I've never seen a human society that didn't have a hierarchy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can call it a class system, but yeah. I think of it more as just hierarchies,
yeah.
You know, and they're hierarchies based on power, on wealth, on all
yeah.
sorts of things. Right now, it's mostly, like, wealth and power sort of have this interesting overlap. I mean, but, you know, say, you know, communist Russia or communist China or something like that, power was political, and, you know, that's where your hierarchy rested. But you still had the hierarchies, you know, you had a supposedly flat society, and yet you have these massive hierarchies, you know, terrifying hierarchies. We seem to like hierarchies.
Yeah.
And we like to enforce them. And when one person gets a little bit of power, we like to enforce them on other people. So, yeah, I think they'll always be around. Yeah.
Well, on that lingering conclusion, Paulo, thanks so much for taking the time out. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you. All right.